Okay, Caribbean Fragosa, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi, Tim. Hi, everybody listening. Thank you for the invitation. It's an honor.
Oh, absolutely. And you're calling us from Los Angeles, from your home in LA. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Nice. Before we begin the interview, which I'm really excited to get to for a lot of reasons, I just want to remind the listeners that this is we're still recording out of our own homes. This is the pandemic version of Words on a Wire. You know, we normally record out of the KTEP studios on campus, on the UTEP campus. But just out of the safety and concern for others and ourselves and our families, we're going to continue to do that out of here. And I say that in case you hear any glitches or pops or snaps, things that are a little funky in the airwaves. That's where that comes from. But Caribbean, it's so exciting to talk with you because first, there's a couple of reasons I want to talk with you. One of them is obviously your brand new book just came out, Eat the Mouth That Feeds You. It's with City Lights. It's an incredible debut collection of short stories, and it's already gotten all kinds of rave reviews and a lot of excitement around it. And I want to talk to you also about your upcoming residency here at UTEP, which will be in the spring. So first, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, keeping healthy, which is the most important part right now, and keeping my family healthy. I have two little ones and we're still living that pandemic life. And just trying to make the best of it. I think it's challenging for everybody. But overall, it's definitely a good time. I'm very pleased with, as you said, the great reception for my book. I've gotten so many wonderful reviews that I didn't expect. I didn't know I was going to get. And it's just been like a wild and amazing ride. And I'm very proud of this collection. It was a long time coming, and I can talk more about that later. But overall, I'm good. And it's been a good year, despite all the craziness of the world.
Right. And I mean, you know, I saw that, and I know you're being a little modest here, because I just saw a few days ago that Reader's Digest came out with a 20 best books by Latinx authors that you want to read right now. And yours is among those 20 great books. And then they go on to say that it may go on to become one of the best short story collections of all time, which is a huge honor and a huge compliment, especially for a debut book. But just, you know, I absolutely would agree with that. It's just a fantastic collection. How does it feel?
It just, it tickles me. I mean, it's just crazy. It's like, oh, wow, you're talking about me and my book. That's wild. Yeah. So it's always an honor. And I'm just like, super humbled every time I hear something like that. I mean, that was just such a huge compliment to hear of all time. Yeah. That's a lot of time.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I'll take it. I mean, I'm happy to receive that positive feedback.
Yeah, you know, and I would tend to agree with that. It wouldn't surprise me if it goes on to, I'm sure it will continue to have a long lasting sort of readership, you know, as time goes on, because, you know, the book, I think it sort of has elements, or at least like these kind of tones of classic collections that we all know and love in the literary community, but even just at large. I think of like, I instantly thought of like even some of the stories of Eduardo Galeano, you know, when I was reading some of the, you play with this mythical idea sometimes and turning sort of everyday lives into these mythical things, you know, into these mythical experiences and people as well. Of course, I have to give a nod as well to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who to me, some of that was coming through in the character of the little girl that gets struck by lightning and suddenly there's like this angelic child appears. And, you know, it's just so many incredible moments throughout the book. I really felt like, wow, this is a book that I would want to read time and time again, and teach certainly as well. But like, why don't we start there? What spurred the idea for this whole collection? Take me back to how this all got started for you.
Yeah, well, this got started, to be perfectly honest, in undergrad. So many, many years ago is when this book got started. And I didn't conceive of it originally as a collection. These were just stories that I wrote over the years, a couple in undergrad, a couple in grad school, and then a whole bunch after. And then some were written as recently as like after the publisher had already accepted the manuscript, I added a couple more stories. Mm-hmm. But I've always been, even though I haven't had like didn't have a specific idea of what I wanted the collection to be about. I've always been very interested in these kinds of characters, meaning characters that are women, that are girls, that have very strong voices and personalities, that are living sometimes dangerous lives, and there's always a lot at risk for them, no matter where they're at or what stage of their life they're in. So I keep returning to these characters. I keep returning to similar places. I grew up in El Monte, in South El Monte, in the San Gabriel Valley in Los Angeles County. And that's really been very fertile ground for me creatively. And for other writers as well, Michael Jaime Becerra, Salvador Plasencia, Tony Margarita Kirkpatrick, fantastic all fiction writers that came out of this little neighborhood that I'm from. Wow. And we all write about this place that is not a remarkable place to look at, but there's actually a lot there historically and currently to be inspired by in Wow. different ways. So anyway, like this return to location, return to certain themes, a return to characters and voices that resonate for me, I think made it like a cohesive collection, even though I didn't conceive of it that way from the start.
Right, right. And I'm glad you mentioned Salvador Plasencia. His book, The People of Paper, was pretty, that was one of the first books actually that jumped into my mind when I began to read your stories. I thought of his work because there's this kind of a surreal quality to it as well. And also like just a fascinating sort of, his creativity was just blew me away when I first read his work, and as does yours. And I'll tell you why, not because I'm surprised by any means, but because I know you as a nonfiction writer. At least that's how I've known you prior to this publication. You know, I know that you publish essays, you're also an editor of nonfiction as well. So suddenly I was like, whoa, wait a minute, wait, Caribbean's writing fiction? That's awesome. And that's like sort of the first sort of solo book out the gate. I know you've been anthologized before as well, but have you always been writing in fiction, or was there kind of a transition, a point where you had to transition between writing nonfiction and going into fiction? Or was that just like, was that just always there for you?
Yeah, that's always been there for me. I did get an MFA in creative writing, and I focused on fiction, a little bit of poetry, but mainly fiction by far at CalArts. And like I said, even in undergrad, I was writing some short stories. I took some creative writing classes with Alicia Gaspar de Alba. Mm. And the fiction has always been there, but as you mentioned, most people, or a lot of people, do know me for the nonfiction stuff. And I think for me, I guess most of the work that I've published up to this point has been nonfiction, because to be perfectly honest, that's been sort of the bread and butter for me. That's where I've been able to make a little money off my writing. And that's kind of the goal for a lot of writers, right? To be able to make some kind of living or some kind of money off your writing. And so that's just kind of where the doors opened up for me all these years, and those were the opportunities that I found, and they've been very fruitful opportunities, and I'm very grateful for that. And that's something I'm always going to keep doing. I'm always going to be writing cultural criticism and other nonfiction work, but really, like, in my core, I'm a fiction writer. And then I guess I could just quickly note for anybody who's interested, because at the core I consider myself a fiction writer above all else, that really, I think, informs, not just informs, but it colors, it shapes the nonfiction as well. I feel like I use a lot of just techniques of fiction writing in nonfiction, which I don't know if other people would have issues with it, but in terms of like illustrating a scene or creating the atmosphere for the reader, or I mean, there's just certain techniques that I borrow from fiction into my nonfiction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, that's what makes, I think, for just a really compelling story. You know, you're a really great storyteller for having the being able to sort of utilize those two tools or those two various genres, you know, to have them and be able to have mastery over those, what you're doing here is just fantastic, you know. I think I can identify a little bit with that, because for me, it was poetry is my first love. And so I write everything, I think, through the lens of poetry, the way I even see stories and prose as well. You're right. So I think it really does influence, even if I write fiction or whether I'm writing nonfiction, there's always a sense of the poetic, I think, because that's the first door I entered, you know, into writing. You know, one of my favorite stories is The Crystal Palace. And I honestly, I kept trying to think of like, why is that one of my favorite stories, Crystal Palace? And I don't really have the answer as to why yet, but I was hoping that you would share an excerpt of that story with our listeners.
Yeah, I have an excerpt prepared. And you do think of why, I'd like to hear, because I noticed that people like that story and it always surprises me. But I picked out an excerpt, and if it goes on too long, Tim, feel free to cut me off.
Okay.
No okay. Way. Crystal Palace. Look, mija, when I was maybe 17 or 18 years old, I worked at a boutique selling fancy French beauty products over there in Guadalajara. The boutique was luxurious, with crystals and mirrors everywhere. Everything sparkled like a diamond, even the little glass bottles filled with the fine lotions. But I felt a little bit nervous. You know, like if I moved too quickly or carelessly, I would break something. I was used to doing things using my strength and with ganas. That's how my ama taught me. You do things with ganas, mija, she would say. With ganas, you pick up the kids, my little brothers, to wipe off the dirty snot dripping from their noses. With ganas, you scrub your father's hard denim pants over the lavadero. And with ganas, you sweep our part of the street so that no one can say we are not clean people. But in this place, La Friu Friu it was called, you did everything very delicately. With finesse, my dear, the Señora Sanz, my boss, would say, look, she would correct me, lifting her tiny little nose. Then she would demonstrate how my work was to be done. With the tippy tips of her fingers, she would pick up a tiny flask containing some precious fluid and carefully place it on the glass display case. You could hear the sweet little sound, a ding, like a little bell every time she showed me how it was to be done. I had the habit of taking the glass bottles and jars five at a time, picking them up and securing them against my breasts, soft and safe. You better believe that breasts are the safest place to keep important things. This is where I keep my coin purse, and mind you, I have never had a single cent stolen. Of course, it's safe so long as you keep it that way and you don't allow busy hands to make their way in there. But to each her own chichis, I always say. This is how I would set up the boutique more quickly, pressing the precious containers against my breasts, until one day, La Señora Sanz came in with her little shoes going click, 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 click over the polished floor. And she screamed so suddenly that it made me jump with fright. Dios mío, she shrieked. I dropped all of the glass jars and bottles, and they broke into a million pieces on the checkered tile. The floor was splattered with precious white creams like the pigeon shit that covered the plaza outside. Such a stupid girl, she screamed at me, spitting out the words between her pearly teeth and red lips. What are you doing? You are a careless fool, a brute. Should I continue, or is this a good place?
Actually, that's a good place right there to stop. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Words on a Wire, and we're in conversation with the LA-based author, fiction writer, and essayist, Caribbean Fragosa. We're talking with her about her new book, Eat the Mouth That Feeds You. It just came out with City Lights. And that was just an excerpt that she read from the story titled Crystal Palace. And, you know, I think as you're reading it, and I have your book here, as you can see, because obviously what the listeners can't see is that you and I are Zooming this call, but you can see that I have it here. It's a fantastic book. And I want to talk a little bit about also the design of it, But as you're reading it, I intentionally was not looking at the story because I wanted to just obviously, you know, get the author just to read that to out loud. It's nice to hear. And it occurred to me, I think a big part of probably why that story resonates with me, I think, is because, and maybe with others, as you said, is that, you know, there is a part of myself, obviously, that I can see my younger self when I was a kid being in these types of, I remember specifically in the town I grew up in Central California, the town of Dinuba, where my grandmother took care of us. There was always this little Rexall pharmacy, and my cousin and I would walk down there and just hang out in there because we could find like, you know, crafts and things like that we could make. There were like these little stick airplanes. We used to like getting there. And there were always these little like sort of like a glass menagerie that was always like around there, and we would touch them. And then they would tell us every time the store owners would basically, you know, they would always like, you know, just get upset with us because we'd be touching these things. And so at a young age, I learned to keep my hands to myself in stores. And then as I got older, accused a couple of times of stealing things that I didn't, I became more aware of my hands in stores, and I always sort of making my hands visible. And then later on, run-ins with the police, in which I always wanted to make sure my hands were visible. But hands suddenly, and the awareness of my hands and the awareness of where they were placed, became very a fragile situation for me, and also just very aware of, hyper aware of that. So I think there was a part, as you're reading it, of this woman going from, as you said, you know, she's being taught to, as a young woman, as a young girl, that, you know, we do everything with ganas, con ganas, you know. But later on in this shop, she suddenly becomes hyper aware of the fragility of her hands touching certain objects, you know, and then the kind of almost the shame that will occur later on in this story that you didn't get to. Anyway, what was the seed for the story? Where did you get this story from?
Yeah, I got it from listening to my mother talk about jobs that she used to have as a young woman before she married my father in Guadalajara. So my family's from Guadalajara. And she grew up like in las afueras and in the peripheries of the city, and just this humble home, this humble neighborhood. But then she would take the bus to the centro, to the city, and would work. She had several jobs in these sort of high-end, very elegant boutiques. And she didn't work in this kind of boutique. She worked like some clothing shop or something, but it was always very special. And her bosses were always these very sort of uptight, like ladies that were super picky about stuff. And so I was always really interested in that sort of contrast, that sort of like moving between worlds, between the space that she lived, where, like you said, and like it says in the story, where she was used to and required to work with ganas, where that's really valued, to use your strength and to do things well using your body, because those are the kinds of jobs that I guess her family had, and that many of our families have had, whether working construction, or my dad was a truck driver, or whatever, in the fields, to working in these very like special little boutiques, these little shops for high-end rich people, basically. It was just kind of jarring to see or to hear that contrast. So I was really interested in that. And I think that was the seed for it, listening to my mother's stories about working there.
And also, you know, you begin the story with the mother saying, "Look, mija, when I was maybe 17 or 18 years old." So the mother begins to give her testimony in a way to her daughter, or it could even be her granddaughter, I don't know, you know. And I know that that you also do like oral history project as well, in partnership with your husband, who's a historian, Romeo Guzman. And then you earlier had said how fiction influences your nonfiction. So in this case, would you say that your nonfiction has influenced some of your own fiction, your fiction as well? Works the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. Yeah. I mean, listening is the best way of learning how to tell a story, learning how to, embody like a kind of rhythm that you put down on the page. There's the way that each person talks and the way that certain families talk, and there's like a rhythm to it and a sound to it and a posture to it. And I've been a good listener all my life. I mean, I as a kid, I just didn't feel like I was listened to. So I did the listening. And plus, I mean, all the chisme was super juicy growing up, listening to the chisme in the kitchen and in the family. So I collected that. And I guess I really was able to fine tune my ear at a young age and really listen to that. And that is absolutely reflected in our fascination, my husband's and my fascination for oral history. And that's definitely something that we still do.
Yeah, absolutely. I tend to agree with that as well. And you have other stories as well, like Ini and Ifati, which I think, you know, are just a fantastic story of two young girls. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, because we kind of are coming up quickly on time, it's passing by so fast, is that, but one of the things I wanted to ask you is that, like, that story, it's a little longer, but it's a fascinating story. And I kept wanting it to continue on. And then I wondered, you know, because this could very easily be its own novel, and you must have been asked already this question, but do you anticipate that any of the characters or stories in this book could go on to have their own book in the future?
Yeah, people have asked about Ini Fati, and Ini Fati actually, and I mean, as a comic book or like a graphic novel, and I wanted to have like a collection of adventures that these two girls might have together. Right. So this was like maybe the opening or like the first issue or something, like the first part of a whole series of adventures. But then Vicious Ladies, the one about the all-girl party crew. Yeah. That could be its own thing. Yeah. But yeah, that is always like an intriguing consideration for me. Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, well, we'd be excited to see that, I'm sure, because like I said, any of these characters could go on. A lot of these characters could go on and have their own lives and books, you know, it'd be fantastic. I want to shift directions here a little bit because I want to maybe use this latter half to talk with you about this exciting opportunity. You have been selected as the next DeWitter Fellow, of which we've only had one prior. It's a brand new program here at the Creative Writing Department at UTEP, University of Texas here in El Paso, you know. And we had the first writer was a poet, and then the second writer we wanted was to be a writer who did fiction. And you know, your name came up and everybody was immediately excited, and then all of a sudden it was time. We were like, oh, and she's got this new book out, oh, it's wonderful. So you know, the committee selected you and we're all excited. What are you looking forward to about coming to El Paso and coming to UTEP?
I mean, El Paso is a fascinating city to me, so I really look forward to getting to know the place. And the bilingual program at UTEP is so unique, and it must be so special to be part of it as a student, but as an instructor, as faculty, that is a whole other opportunity that I don't know if it's possible as of now anywhere else. It might be, but not quite like El Paso. I mean, El Paso, as I've learned from people, is its own unique place and thing, and the people that come there are super special. So I really look forward to exploring the bilingual aspect more. I mean, I've never taken really, truly a bilingual writing class. There were some elements of that in other workshops I've taken many years ago, but not quite like this. So I really look forward to working with students in English, Spanish, or Spanglish, or anything in between. So it's just super exciting.
Yeah, you'll get all of that for sure in your classrooms. And I should clarify that the residency is actually for the spring semester. So you'll come sometime in late January and stay till the end of the semester. And that's what the DeWitter Fellowship is really about. It's about giving our students at UTEP in the creative writing program a one-on-one kind of engaged classroom experience with Latinx authors who are making waves out there. And you're obviously, you are, you know, and so we're really excited to have you, you know. I wanted to ask you, and actually one of the questions I had, we have a couple more minutes left here, was what projects do you have coming up? However, I checked this morning because I'm a fan of your husband's work as well, Romeo Guzman's work, and I saw that he posted on his Facebook, it says, Kari and I just submitted a book proposal for a co-edited book thing. We're pretty good at this co thing. So how long have you two been doing this co thing? And you know, what's the what exciting projects are coming up?
Yeah, so that particular one, we're pitching a book to Heyday, which is a press in Berkeley, and it's a collection of writings about place. to put it simply, about in California. So we are really continuing and in the vein of writing about places that are typically ignored or just kind of overlooked, especially in publishing and in the media. So we've got neighborhoods that I'd never heard of before, actually. And we have some great writers like Janice Miller. She wrote about Black Panamanian LA. And then we have a piece for about Dinuba, actually. Yeah, so Bryn Saito, she teaches at Fresno State, is writing about that. So we have a whole bunch of pieces that we hope will find the home somewhere.
That's exciting. I'm sure it will find a home. And, you know, Heyday Books, I mean, I love them. They were my first publisher ever. They published Skin Tax, my first book, which was poetry. And they just were really wonderful people and still are. So I have a special place in my heart for Heyday Books and the work that they do, especially particularly for California authors, you know? I'm excited about that. Well, I mean, I guess we're running out of time here. Yeah, we should probably call it close. That's so fast. I there's so many more questions I have here that I wanted to get to, but that's just how it happens when the conversation's good.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, can we keep going?
I know. But we will definitely, Caribbean, we'll be excited to have you here, like I said, at UTEP. But, you know, we're going to plan some events with you when you're here. And, you know, the local community certainly will get a chance to engage with you more. But otherwise, the online community will be able to find this through our Words on a Wire and through our podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Great. Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
All right. Take care and good luck with all the things coming forward with your book.
Thanks. Gracias.